hppodcraft.com.
At 5 o'clock, Ed Lois washed up, tossed on his hat and coat, got his car out, and headed across town towards his TV sales store. He was tired. His back and shoulders ached from digging dirt out of the basement and wheeling it into the backyard. But for a 40-year-old man, he had done okay. Janet could get a new vase with the money he had saved, and he liked the idea of repairing the foundations himself.
That was the opening of The Hanging Stranger, a story by Philip K. Dick that I was told features space monsters of some kind, and as of press time, this theory has been confirmed.
Yes.
And we are going to show you our analysis and our test results here on HP Podcraft, Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. Philip K. Dick is pretty big. He's a big deal. Lots of stories have been adapted of his into big-time movies. Blade Runner, Total Recall, Minority Report, Scanner Darkly. I could go on and on.
Yeah, it's insane how uniquely suited the type of thing he does is to movies.
It has a very, even this story has a very cinematic feel to it, in his writing style.
Who is that reader that we heard at the top?
None other than Wilman Black.
Welcome back, Wilman Black.
Wilman has been very busy lately. He is building a one-to-one scale replica of the Sears Tower, and I don't know how far along he is on that, but best of luck.
Wow, that's a crazy thing to be doing, especially I don't think it's called the Sears Tower anymore.
No, he's building it as it was when it was called the Sears Tower.
What a niche thing to be doing. I think it looks virtually identical, but I'm glad that he qualifies it that way.
It's his thing, you know?
It's his thing, man. You know, he knows about it and we don't. Like a lot of these foundational science fiction writers that we're going to cover on here, I haven't read a lot of Phil K. Dick, actually.
No.
Maybe some stories and anthologies.
I've read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? I think that's it.
Yeah, that's pretty much it for me as well. I remember reading that, really liking it. You were mentioning movies. I saw that movie, The Adjustment Bureau, a few years ago. Do you remember that?
Is that with Matt Damon?
Yeah, that's so funny because the title is awful.
Yeah.
And I couldn't remember what it was called. So I go, it's that Matt Damon fights the madman guy in a hat. That's what that movie's called. I searched on that and the Adjustment Bureau came up right away, but it was auto-completed. You know, somebody else went, Matt Damon, Guy in Hat. What the hell is that movie called? He's a master of what they call high concept. That's why he's popular in Hollywood. Yeah. It's pretty easy to describe whatever the sci-fi twist is in his stories. But what was surprising to me, well, maybe not so surprising, but a little refreshing, was that the story was written really well versus the other authors that we've covered so far this month who are a little ham-fisted with the way that they go about things. This is a real pro at work. I jumped in at the beginning of it and I really couldn't put it down. It scared the hell out of me, this story. So good work, Philip K. Dick.
Now, who is Philip K. Dick?
I don't know. Can you enlighten me?
He was born Philip Kindred Dick. Kindred.
Wow.
Is his middle name.
Yeah, that's a surprise to me.
It was his mother's maiden name.
Well, that seems like some kind of sneaky trick from olden times, naming yourself Kindred, putting people at ease. You know, you can slip into any crowd and I heard somebody say he's Kindred. I don't know. I guess we should let him have wedding cake. He's got to be related to somebody.
He was born in Illinois, like all great people, Chicago specifically, in 1928.
Born there and then took off to California like even all greater people.
Exactly.
Ray Bradbury is who I'm referring to.
Oh, not me.
Your story is yet to be written.
His family moved to San Francisco, to the San Francisco Bay Area when he was 5. He started reading the pulps and sci-fi stuff when he was about 12 years old. He was in the same class at the same school as Ursula K. Le Guin, but they never knew each other at the time.
Just dicks passing in the night, as they say.
Why is she a dick?
I don't know. The phrase doesn't work. Le Guin's passing in the night doesn't have the same ring to
dicks it. Dicks and Le Guin's passing in the night.
Oh, you cracked it.
Yeah, that's the winner right there.
Get our t-shirt account going.
He went to UC Berkeley but dropped out right away, supposedly due to anxiety problems. He had some wild beliefs. He called himself a cosmic panentheist, and that the universe is an extension of God. In a way, the world isn't entirely real, and there's no way to confirm whether it is actually here or not. That's one of his beliefs.
It's not too out there, at least from my cursory reading, in that, or at least the idea that the world is mostly our internal sensory perception of something that's ultimately unknowable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what he means by it being an extension of God. Did he attribute actual God characteristics like in an organized religion to that? Do you know?
Not as far as I understood, but I only have done a short reading of his biography. I haven't gotten into the details of it.
Well, only recently did I hear about the fact that he wrote it. You know, there was a, I think, posthumously published book of a lot of his writing about this kind of stuff that I do want to dig into at some point because it's pretty interesting to me. That paranoid idea that other machines are at work behind a veil of perception is apparently present in most of his work and in his stories. Definitely is in this story.
Yeah.
And you see it in Blade Runner. That can be really frightening, but Rachel discovering that her memories are implants mm-hmm. is such a scary concept. But at the same time, to me, it's a little comforting to think about that. When I feel any distress over the past, I'll think, well, you know, in a certain way, all memories are implants. Things are beginning right now. The only real thing is right now in the present. And anything that we remember, yes, there might be physical evidence of it. But in general, it's all in the memory banks of the people who shared that experience. Yeah. And as such, it's just as real as a story or anything like that.
Yeah.
So you can sort of, you know, in a way think, okay, time begins right now, because as far as I know, none of those things ever happened. The subjectiveness of reality is sort of a way that I find comfort, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. That's how I rationalize all my murders.
That's one way to use that. Mm-hmm. I was thinking more about doing things actively in the present rather than dwelling in something that's no longer real. But if you are trying to justify something awful that you did, works that way too. Yeah. It's an elastic idea.
It's great. His first sold short story was Rogue, and that was in 1951. It was about a confused dog.
Cool. Well, that's about enough bio. let's just...
His first novel was Solar Lottery, which came out in 1955. He wrote sci-fi for a few years. He won the Hugo in 1963 for The Man in the High Castle, which is an existing television series. It's on right now, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, he had a lot of problems. Drug and depression troubled him his whole life. Always had money problems.
I mean, relatable.
Yeah. In 1974, he had some sodium pentothal after a wisdom tooth was removed, and it caused him to have hallucinations, which made him think, this is a quote, "I experienced an invasion of my mind by a transcendently rational mind, as if I had been insane all my life, and suddenly I became sane."
I found out about that, and I know that he did some writings after that about the experience, and I want to find out all about it. Something similar happened to Mary Steenburgen.
What?
The actress.
Really?
I'm not kidding. In a sort of a different way.
Okay.
But she went under anesthetic about 10 or 11 years ago. And when she came out, she felt like her brain was rewired. She started perceiving everything as music.
Whoa.
It happened like immediately. I read an article that was in Rolling Stone about it. And, you know, she came out and said, as soon as it was wearing off, you know, my brain was only music. I'm looking at the article right now. Mm-hmm. Everything anybody said to me became musical. All my thoughts became musical. Every street sign became musical. I couldn't get my mind into any other mode. And she went through this like period of time where she kind of went insane. Her son was saying it was weird. She was listening to all these indie bands and trying out the accordion and playing all these instruments. But eventually she wrote like 100 songs.
Whoa.
And actually Universal signed her. Now in the story, it says she actually submitted these to somebody, you know, under her mother's name. And so on the credit of the song itself, she got like grabbed up. Mary Steenburgen.
Wow.
Obviously, you're married to Ted Danson. You're a famous actress. You can probably just get that done. But no, Universal signed her. And she's had a couple of her songs featured in films and stuff. I think she was up for some awards for some movie. She's a legit songwriter now. But it happened because of some surgery.
Mm, how bizarre.
And I think that, you know, that also reminds me of experiences that people have in psilocybin kind of magic mushroom experiences where they maybe feel this interconnectedness mm-hmm. is what a lot of people describe from these hallucinatory experiences that then goes on to solve a lot of problems for them because they've experienced what a lot of them will say is I saw God. Mm. But I think it's really more about really feeling connected to the universe in a way that you haven't experienced before that then changes your perception of things. For some people, that solves long-lasting depression or addiction issues. For other people, I think they become musicians, or in his case, he plugged into some intelligence he then believed was really that we all are a part of.
Yeah.
And you said that caused him to think. I mean, who knows? Maybe he's right.
Maybe.
You know, but how horrific would that be? It's kind of in theme with what we've been talking about this year, this invasion of the body snatchers kind of thing that's coming up. And when we did that episode with Jamie and he was talking about in that film there's a guy screaming at the beginning and everybody thinks he's crazy. And by the end, the main guy is the guy screaming at everybody and trying to let them know that this is going on. And this is another one of those things.
He had a lot of experiences that he said were supernatural or he believed were supernatural, but he also had some paranoid events that happened in his life. It sounds like he was suffering from maybe an undiagnosed schizophrenia from the things that I've read about him, but like not great. We're not going to go into too much detail because it's pretty sad stuff, but he was married 5 times. He had 3 kids and he died in 1982 after having a stroke 4 months before Blade Runner came out.
Very young. Hard to hear that. When I think of that name, I think of it from the point of view of being a child looking at those books. And to me, all those authors are sort of pipe smoking old men. Mm-hmm. And you get to be our age and then you go, wow, these are my contemporaries. No, they weren't old at all.
Yeah. Now, I know we're going to cover more Philip K. Dick because he is a seminal writer of science fiction.
Yeah, and I really love the story.
So let's get into it. This story, The Hanging Stranger, was published in December 1953 issue of Science Fiction Adventures.
Now that is a great title, Science Fiction Adventures. And I don't mean to be so easily impressed, but somehow it's more impressive in this technologically advanced world that we live in that I can pick up a stack of paper that says Science Fiction Adventures on it, kind of stare at a couple of those pages for a while, and have a science fiction adventure. You know, it yeah. still works. Yeah. No Wi-Fi or anything. It's magic.
Yep.
It's magic. Also, you know what else is magical? Our neighbor's cat hops on our balcony and creeps into the apartment here and there. And the other day she stole some money. That's another thing. There was some change out. She grabbed a quarter and ran for it. So there's magic everywhere if you look for it, folks. That's what I wanted to say. Anyway.
The story begins with this guy, Ed Lois, going into work late in the afternoon. He owns a television sales and repair shop. He was busy during the day digging out the cellar, doing work on his house. Now he's 40 years old. He's got a wife who's out during the day and twin boys. They're at school.
I thought maybe him digging the cellar and being tired was a way to just show his age or something like that, because, you know, context matters. If this story had opened with him digging a cellar during marches for Dracula's,
yes,
I would have been very interested in what he was doing. Or if you'd found out about him having twins during Septwinber, just the month we do about twins being cold as ice to each other, I'd be worried about that too. But here it just seems like some setup. And I don't know if you get more 50s of a name than Ed Lois.
Yeah.
That name just says flat top. And as a character occupation, I also love that he owns the TV sales shop. Because even to this day, when you want to show anonymous citizens reacting to a big world event, what do? They're looking in the window of the TV shop when they're standing out on this, you know, yes. on the street. Mm-hmm. A group of people gather. It's Godzilla. And it seems like of anybody, the guy who owns that TV sales shop should have the best grip on what's going on in the world, because they are the expositional device for all of the townspeople.
I see, yeah.
And so I thought it was such a neat profession to put him in, given what happens.
Yeah. Now, he pulls into the town square where his shop is, and he sees something hanging from a lamppost. He's not sure what it is at first, but he quickly figures out it's a body, a guy in a suit. He's all dirty, a little messed up, but it's a dead man hanging from a lamppost. So he runs into the nearby shops, asks this guy, Don. He's like, hey, there's a dead guy hanging out there. Don is like, it's nothing to get worked up about. Must be a good reason if there's a guy hanging off a lamppost out there. Then another guy comes in, sees Ed's getting worked up about this, and he too doesn't seem very worried about the body at all. Ed wants to call the police.
The horror of this gripped me right away.
Oh, yeah.
The scenario, you know, and we've talked about this before, how in the city, oftentimes, if there's a significant homeless population, you might have that scenario where you think, am I seeing a body or is that somebody asleep?
Oh, God, yeah.
And it feels so creepy to have that sensation. Or is this a prank?
Yeah.
You know, even with somebody hanging from a tree, I could see you going, is this a Halloween thing? What's going on? This reasoning is even worse when he's telling people about it. There's a body hanging from the lamppost, Lois said. I'm going to call the cops. They must know about it, Potter said, or otherwise it wouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
That scary leap in logic, it's something that's come into sharper focus in recent years. This assumption that somebody's in charge. You know, this sort of complacent trust in the system.
Yeah.
The funny thing is when you have that complacent trust in a system, it's actually how the system gets corrupted.
Yeah.
It has to be present for that system to get corrupted. And to take it outside of current events, I mean, I think of me being a dumb teenager with my first car, maintenance, just not something I thought about. Once it works, you know? And so I remember the mechanic saying, you didn't put any oil in this thing, you know?
Mm.
No, is that something you have to do? I thought the oil went in and that was kind of just it. I think that anything that's a system, so that applies to machines, which have to be in a constant state of improvement and iteration, so goes it with systems of belief, governance, even interpersonal interaction, our beliefs about ourselves and others, constant state of improvement and iteration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why you find characters at the beginning of stories in a place of stasis, because stasis and death, basically the same thing. When you die, that's when you stop changing. Stories overall, in a way, are trying to get us to stop being complacent. Mm-hmm. Don't give up, because Look what happens. You've got to take action because the world isn't going to let you just sit there and be happy. Now, Potter had other reasons for saying what he said to the protagonist, but the author had him say it that way on purpose to bring up. Well, I say the author because I don't know how to refer to him. I don't want to say Dick had him say that way on purpose. I thought about calling him K-Dick, but now it sounds like I'm doing a radio station like K-Dick 101 playing all the sci-fi hits.
Or some Korean pop music. I'm not exactly sure.
K-Dick is huge right now.
More people are showing up and Ed's just getting more freaked out. No one seems concerned about the body. They think Ed is sick, so they call a doctor. Ed wants them to call the freaking police. Eventually, some cops show up and they ask him a bunch of questions. But again, don't seem too worried about the body. They ask him where he's been all day and what he's been doing. And he says he was in the basement of his house alone. And they decide to take Ed in, so they put him in the squad car. And they got a lot of questions about where he was. Very specifically, were you alone? You know, what was going on? Why were you there? What was happening?
I mentioned the writing in this story is good. This is an example. He skips details. It says the crowd melted respectfully for the two heavyset cops moving efficiently toward Lois. Name? The cop with the notebook murmured. Lois, he mopped his forehead wearily. Edward Lois, listen to me back there. Address? The cop demanded. The police car moved swiftly through traffic. So they got him into the car.
Yeah.
And started moving along, and he didn't bother telling you about it. He just made the cut. You know, it was a nice edit. But I think also the purpose of that is to, aside from keeping things moving, keeping things pacey, it contributes to our experience of Ed's internal perception of the world as a construct of, you know, solid memories with some blurry connective tissue. Is it important what happened to get him into the car? No. In the next moment, he was in the car. It's sort of like, how many times have you driven somewhere and then thought, I have no recollection of that at all?
Yeah.
I was there and now I'm here. The story, in a way, I felt simulated that, the writing style, which was pretty neat. It's credible that he wouldn't suspect the police at first, even though they're being antagonistic toward him, because I don't know if that's ever happened. Have you ever called the police on somebody or for some reason and then had them sort of treat you like a criminal?
No.
That's happened to me before, where there was a sort of fight happening in the street. And when I called the police, they were, what are you doing? What were you doing out? Where were you? Are you, you know, you guys been drinking? What's the deal here? And we were like, geez, we saw somebody being chased. I'm worried about this person, you know?
Yeah.
So this seemed like credible police behavior to me, actually. Sometimes they're just not helpful.
Mm-hmm. So the cops tell him that the body hanging there is official. It's supposed to be hanging there for everyone to see. And Ed says, good Lord, I guess I sort of went off the deep end. I thought maybe something had happened, you know, something like the Ku Klux Klan, some kind of violence, communist or fascist taking over. He wiped his face with his breast pocket handkerchief, his hands shaking. I'm glad to know it's all on the level. Now, as they get closer to the police station, Hall of Justice, they call it, which
is
strange. Yeah. Ed just decides he's going to roll out of the moving car.
I know. The Hanging Stranger is the right title for this story, I think. But it also easily could have been The Ejector. No seat could hold him.
He says they weren't cops. He realized that right away. He knew every cop in Pikeville. A man couldn't own a store, operate a business in a small town for 25 years without getting to know all the cops. So he runs around and he manages to lose the police. He's sneaking, you know, back alleys, down side streets, trying to figure out what the heck's going on. And then he looks at City Hall.
In that space of time where he's evading the police, that actually is some kind of nice action that he writes there. You know, he runs up a stairwell and goes across a rooftop. And I thought of it as that sequence when they do that specific kind of action for some reason always feels like the composer gives up. The film composer just starts hitting things that are in the studio. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
With action scenes like that, the piano's always like digga 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 digga, and then some weird like percussion sticks. But a little, little. I mean, they're just hitting stuff in the room. Done.
Yeah, sounds good.
Above the city hall was a patch of darkness, a cone of gloom denser than the surrounding night, a prism of black that spread out and was lost into the sky. He listened. Good God, he could hear something. Something that made him struggle frantically to close his ears, his mind, to shut out the sound. A buzzing. A distant, muted hum like a great swarm of bees. Lois gazed up, rigid with horror, the splotch of darkness hanging over City Hall. Darkness so thick it almost seemed solid. In the vortex, something moved. Flickering shapes, things descending from the sky, pausing momentarily above the City Hall, fluttering over it in a dense swarm and then dropping silently onto the roof. Shapes. Fluttering shapes from the sky. From the crack of darkness that hung above him, he was seeing them. They were landing. coming down in groups, landing on the roof of City Hall and disappearing inside. They had wings, like giant insects of some kind. They flew and fluttered and came to rest, and then crawled, crab-fashioned, sideways across the roof and into the building.
You said, let's do this Philip K. Dick story. You weren't sure if there was a monster in here or not. You know, is it going to be in theme? And I said, You know what? Even if there's no monster, I'll just say the monster was us all along.
Yes.
And I'll get away with it. Mm-hmm. But some Insecticons showed up.
Insecticons. God bless them. And we have a giant portal, a rift in space above this building. This thing where these giant bug dudes are coming into our world. Ed sees one of them flutter to the ground and then take the shape of a person, which made me think of Mimic, that Donald Wolheim story that we covered.
Yeah.
He decides he needs to get home, so he jumps on the bus. He gets on. No one seems to notice him. There's a business guy on the bus, a young woman in an Angora sweater.
Welcome to the 50s.
There's a chubby lady. All these people, they seem stuck in the rut of their daily lives. He says, going home with their minds dead, controlled, filmed over with the mask of an alien being that had appeared and taken possession of them, their town, their lives, himself too, except that he happened to be deep in his cellar instead of in the store. Somehow he had been overlooked. They had missed him. Their control wasn't perfect, foolproof. Maybe there were others.
So that's what the cellar was about.
So a guy reading a newspaper seems to be looking at him where everybody else isn't. And he thinks, well, wait a minute. Maybe this guy is in the same position that I'm in, or maybe he's an alien in disguise. I don't know. So he just kind of goes, you know, I'm going to get out of here. I'm not going to risk it. So he pulls the stop on the bus. And then as the bus is slowing down, he just jumps off the bus right away.
That's what he's the ejector, dude. This summer, he can't wait to get on the road again. Ejector 2.
So this man also jumps off the bus, chases Ed. Ed finds a rock, kicks the guy, freaking beats him with a rock. And the guy says, stop, for God's sake, listen.
That's one time where his skipping in action and doing the edits worked against, you know, Philip K. Dick, because I wanted to know the details. What kind of kick are we talking about here? Did he land one in the face? Was it a roundhouse? Describe the kick.
Ed doesn't listen to this dude, and he just kills the guy with a rock. Honestly, he's not sure if the guy was an alien or not.
Mondays, am I right?
So he makes it home, tells his wife, grab her coat, get the kids, we're getting the hell out of here, don't pack anything. He tells her what's going on. Like, he's just upfront about everything. She thinks he's going crazy, but she's going to go along with it.
When you marry the ejector, you know, you're going to be moving around a lot. He pretty much has one strategy for dealing with things. Get out.
He explains he wants to get out of town and get help, let everybody know what's going on, that this invasion is happening. She calls for the twins. One of them comes down. Ed yells for the other twin. But what comes down is not his son.
He heard the buzz and dropped instantly, the long butcher knife out. Sickened, he saw it coming down the stairs at him, wings a blur of motion as it aimed itself. It still bore a vague resemblance to Jimmy. It was a baby one. A brief glimpse, the thing hurtling at him, cold, multi-lensed in human eyes. Wings, body still clothed in yellow t-shirt and jeans, the mimic outline still stamped on it. A strange half-turn of its body as it reached him. What was it doing? A stinger. Lois stabbed wildly at it. It retreated, buzzing frantically. Lois rolled and crawled towards the door. Tommy and Janet stood still as statues, faces blank, watching without expression. Lois stabbed again. This time, the knife connected. The thing shrieked and faltered. It bounced against the wall and fluttered down.
Oh, I was so scared that he was insane and murdering a child. I was so worried about it.
I thought the same thing, but no.
No, but I mean, it's fluttering around and stuff, so I'm pretty sure this is happening.
So Ed gets this feeling that something is trying to take over his mind. He's paralyzed for a second, and then it stops as the thing on the ground is finally dead. His wife and his son are just standing there paralyzed. They're not moving. So are they actually his real wife and son? If they are his real wife and son, and his other son got taken over by one of these insect things, what happened to his real son? Was he murdered? Was he eaten? Did it go into his body and like take over it? What's going on? We don't get any answers.
Yeah, the specifics of that aren't laid out in here at all. I thought that they were probably aliens just because they sort of stopped moving. Very body snatcher-ish. Like, their strategy was to trick him. And when that didn't work, they just stop.
But the one came down in his insectoid form and attacked him with a stinger. And the other two just kind of stood there paralyzed, like no reaction, he says specifically.
It's a weird scene, but there's just no way she wouldn't. The reason I think it's not them primarily is because he beats the thing to death. And if it was, well, of course, if it doesn't look like her son, why would she jump in to defend it?
No, well, she's...
Yeah,
no,
you're right.
They're paralyzed, like as in a supernatural... Because something tried to grab a hold of his mind, and it didn't work. And they're rigid. They don't react to anything that happens. They're just like statues. Maybe one of his kids got taken over because it's wearing his son's clothes, this insect thing, which is really messed up.
That's like the Brood from X-Men or something like that. Kind of reminds me.
Yeah, yeah.
I just figured they were, that's probably, they're either mind controlled or they're aliens, because there's no way one twin is going to watch the other twin get beat to death right in front of him. That would be cold as ice. And we don't cover stories like that till September.
Oh, it was a setup. I didn't even realize
this is crazy space monster month.
Yes, of course. Ed runs off on his own. He goes through the woods, walks the whole night through to get to the next town over. He doesn't stop until he can't feel the buzzing noise anymore. It's like in his mind. But when he gets to a point, it just goes away. So he feels like, okay, I'm past their control, their influence. He finds this gas station, tells the attendant that the whole next town is lost. I need to get to the police station. We cut to him in the interrogation room. The cops turn off the recorder. Ed says, you don't believe me, but the officer in charge, he says, you know what? We do believe you. Ed explains he's got a theory. He thinks these things have been trying to take over for thousands of years. Evil spirits like Beelzebub, they are depicted in the Bible as insects, or in mythology as insects. They aren't demons. They're some kind of aliens. And humans, specifically says the Hebrews, had to fight them off like thousands of years ago. And then their myth around it is based in some kind of historical account of this prior invasion. Ed admits that he killed a regular person because he thought he might have been one of them to the cops. The cop says, hey, don't worry about it. We understand where you were going through, but you seem to have this whole thing figured out. And he says, well, I do, but what was up with the body? Why was that man hanging up in the town square? And the cop says, well, simple. It was bait to draw you out, make you declare yourself so they know who was under control and who had escaped. And he says, well, he never saw that man before. He wasn't from his town. He was a stranger, all muddy and dirty. Oh no, just like Ed is all muddy and dirty from going through the woods. It ends with this little epilogue. This guy, Clarence Mason, a banker, he's going to his car at the end of the day and he sees something hanging from the lamppost.
Mason approached it warily. He wanted to get home. He was tired and hungry. He thought of his wife, his kids, a hot meal on the dinner table. But there was something about the dark bundle, something ominous and ugly. The light was bad. He couldn't tell what it was. Yet it drew him on, made him move closer for a better look. The shapeless thing made him uneasy. He was frightened by it, frightened and fascinated. And the strange part was that nobody else seemed to notice it.
What a brutal ending. Well, horrible revelation.
Pretty weird, this tale as well. I know it's sci-fi, but there's so much of it that's not explained.
Yeah, and there's a lot of it. My impacts weren't skewing towards conceptual science fiction. This was more about current society in a lot of ways.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
The lesson I took away is don't help people. They're bait.
No, it made me think of like that feeling too. I'm sure everybody feels at some point that the world's crazy and that
yes,
there are things that are going on and nobody's, like you were talking about responsibility, that nobody's doing anything about it. And you point it out to people and point people just kind of go, whatever.
Yeah.
The whole idea that there's people starving in our world is insane. We have got enough food for the whole world. Like we just, it's a simple fact. We do. There's logistics involved of getting food to those people. There's so many things that go on in the world that people go, why is this happening? This doesn't need to happen. And yet people just kind of go,
And Candide set up that theme, which is why I felt that that was a good foundational book for science fiction, right? Because the whole thing that he was trying to convey is that we're just telling ourselves a story that these are the way things go, even though they are patently absurd when you look right at it.
Yeah.
And here we have that. He is looking at a body hanging in the park and he's saying, aren't you guys distressed? And they're going, hey, it's probably up there for a reason. No big deal. So he's wandering around upset. Aren't you guys freaked out by this? How many times have you had that conversation with friends?
Yeah.
Where you say, aren't I feel like everybody should be a lot more freaked out than they are.
Yeah.
But our ability to adapt causes us to not be freaked out. Even like in the current state of the world that we're in right now, where so many insane things are going on, you know, the workaday works its way in, and pretty soon you're just kind of used to it.
Yeah.
Less able to be shocked.
Especially living through this pandemic. Hopefully it'll be another 100 years before a big thing like this will happen again. It's become so normal now, just the way that we're living. At least I am. I've gotten used to it.
Of course. Yeah. And now the reentry is going to be difficult. Everybody's going to feel very alien for a while.
Yeah.
And that's kind of going to be its own thing. Just like coming back from war and trying to reintegrate into society or something like that. Everybody's suffered this massive trauma that they've, to an extent, been unable. It's not an individual trauma since everybody's gone through it. It's like a kind of a hard thing for people to have discussed. And so people are going to be coming out of that in some strange ways. But yeah. So that's why this is such a good story. It makes you think about those current experiences. It also reminded me of, you know, some insidious things in advertising, specifically talking about how they're using these people for bait to suss out who hasn't been changed or who hasn't been converted.
Yeah.
And it's an aspect of, say, this happens on the internet where in some cases, say, when you unsubscribe, you know, you get an email you don't want and you click the link and you go and enter in your email and say, unsubscribe me. Well, most cases you actually are getting pulled off a list, but in some, they're just trying to prove if there's a person there. You confirmed that you read email. So sometimes, just like in a psychological experiment, the thing that you're doing, you think is one thing, but they're actually testing something else. There is push advertising that is about provoking a negative reaction from you because it tells the person things about you. Yep. And a lot of social media does that, where they do things that are going to irritate you because that's a certain kind of interaction that has its own value. Yeah. It's hard for us to perceive it because it's negative. But if you reply stop to some junk mail person that's bugging you, well, they just learned something valuable. There's a person at the end of that phone number and they can sell that information to another vendor. And this is very much like that. Yeah. It's pretty horrific. Yes. And it reminded me of that Richard Matheson, I think it's Richard Matheson's story, The Box, where, you know, you can, if you open the box, you get money, but it kills somebody you don't know. Right. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you become the victim for the next person who opens that box. And this is similar. He's the hanging stranger now. It all comes around. What a good story. And it's I love these themes that are developing this year.
Yeah, it's really good stuff. I'm glad we're dipping into some Philip K. Dick. I want to thank our reader, Wilman Black. Wilman, good luck on that Sears Tower. I don't know how far along you are, but it's probably going to take a while and a lot of money.
I can't wait to see it. I really can't. I don't know. You know, probably you'll have to send me a photo. So it will be indistinguishable from the actual Sears Tower, and you probably could just...
It's one-to-one scale, so it is... Hopefully, if he does a good job, you will not be able to tell the difference.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He probably could take a photo of the one in Chicago, Photoshop a different background, and I wouldn't know the difference, and he wouldn't have had to waste all that time and money, but nevertheless, a worthwhile endeavor.
He would never do that. Why would you even suggest that?
Man, you're really upset at me. I'm sorry. We just had to edit out a whole lot of cursing, and yeah. I'm sorry that I suggested that.
He is a man of honor, so please besmirch. I'd like to thank some patrons. Firstly, I'd like to thank Alice Lehman.
I would like to thank Curtis Ham.
Lewis Evans, thanks.
Jared Ransom, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Drew Christie.
I'd like to thank Heather Allardyce.
I'd like to thank Elijah Stamps.
I'd like to thank Keith Martin.
Nick! Thank you.
And finally, Jedi Master Cthulhu. Thank you so much. Oh, man. He can change shape, use the Force, dreams.
He's a Jedi.
Yeah. What's Cthulhu really but just a giant Yoda with tentacles on his face? Wow. In our current day.
My mind is blown.
Instead of a different galaxy and underwater. I mean, it's basically the same thing.
It's the same thing.
Glad to have your patronage.
Yes. Thank you, all patrons. You're all wonderful people. And without your support, our ship wouldn't still be sailing. And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to HP Podcraft.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories. Would Jedi Master Cthulhu have Midi-Chthonians in his bloodstream? Oh, boy. Stop the recording. Stop it.
HPPodcraft.com.